Father, we do come before you cognizant of the fact that time is short, life is short, and you give us a certain time, a certain season to live out our life before you, and we pray that we do that faithfully, honorably, and always be aware of the times. And thank you for this time together this morning. Time spent in your word is always time well spent, and we do want that time that we spend this morning looking over your word and thinking over these principles of giving to be a time that honors you and that proves worthwhile in each of our lives. I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. So just the overview we've been giving, we were looking at the question of tithing and noticed that while we don't tithe in the New Covenant, we are commanded to give generously and cheerfully. So we spent the last several weeks, not just few now, it's been several, looking at the question, so who should we be giving to? And we've looked at several categories so far. We're making our way through. In fact, I believe we might finish today, but we'll see. This particular segment. So we looked at giving to pastors, elders. We looked at giving to ministers of the gospel. We looked for quite some time at giving to the poor. I think we kind of wrapped that up last week. And today we have left a category that I've been saying is kind of the miscellaneous category, other areas of giving. So that's what we're going to focus on today, is kind of the miscellaneous hodgepodge. Didn't fit in any kind of box or category that I just thought we needed to kind of walk through. And hopefully this will wrap it up for us today. So that's where we are, other areas of giving. And just to kind of give you a quick overview of where I'm headed, I'd like for us to take a look at a couple other areas, New Testament giving, which are not directly mentioned in the New Testament, but I believe are legitimate, God-honoring things to which we might give. And specifically, I want to look at giving towards the finances associated with the local church meeting place, something that kind of the elephant in the room. We don't necessarily... wasn't on my big list, you know, but we'll talk about that. And giving to God-honoring organizations. I mean, we've talked about the local church, obviously, but besides that. And then there's this other kind of category. It's not really giving to or whatever, but it's just a topic I thought was worthy of our attention. The idea of giving corporately versus individually. There's a thing about that that I see going on in Scripture, and I just kind of want us to notice that and think about it a little bit. So that's where we're going today. This is the hodgepodge as I've seen it. You may throw in something else if you want to, and you're certainly welcome to do that. So let's start. The need to finance a church meeting place. So we've talked about the need to support our pastors and giving to those in need in our local church family. But another practical area of financial need in most local churches is paying the costs associated with the building in which the church meets. Now, we'll state the obvious. Obviously, the New Testament does not explicitly command us to even meet in a building, much less give money towards securing and maintaining one. Right? I mean, you won't find a passage on that. Indeed, we could go a step further and say there are many New Testament examples of believers meeting outdoors, right? You know, Jesus often taught outdoors, Sermon on the Mount, for example. Paul's speech to the Ephesian elders, which is the only formal speech addressed to believers recorded in the book of Acts, it seems to have taken place kind of in the harbor before Paul got on the boat. Maybe it was in a building, I don't know, he didn't say, but you don't get that impression, at least I don't. At the end of a week's stay in Tyre on one of his missionary journeys, Paul prayed with the local believers, including women and children, on the beach before boarding a ship for Jerusalem. That was an outdoor gathering there. But obviously, there are practical reasons why it makes sense for regular church meetings to take place indoors, which is why we see many New Testament examples of believers meeting in a building of some kind. So it's not like they always met outside and we suddenly changed that. Plenty of New Testament examples of meeting in some sort of structure or building. Again, kind of stating the obvious, but I mean, let's just get it out there and lay it on the table and look at it, right? So you probably know that for a period of time after the resurrection, the apostles and the early church met in the Jewish temple and in homes. Because it was really, Christianity was an outgrowth of Judaism originally, obviously. Because all the original disciples, Jesus himself was a Jew. And then when Paul came along, of course, it began moving in the direction of Gentiles. But so we see passages like Acts chapter 2, verse 46. Day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in homes. Or many signs and wonders done among the people by the apostles. They were all together in Solomon's portico. And that's like a colonnade on the east end of the temple. It's just part of the temple where they met. Every day in the temple, from house to house, Acts chapter 5 talks about, they did not cease teaching and preaching that Jesus is the Christ. The gathering of believers in the temple on any kind of regular basis apparently continued until persecution forced members of a Jerusalem church out of the city. And we see that in Acts chapter 8. So that's when they got pushed out, and meeting in the temple was no longer an option. So there had to be another place found. We have a specific example of the Apostle Paul when he came to Ephesus, which is the place, the New Testament church he probably spent the greatest amount of time in, at least as far as what Luke records for us. He preached for 3 months in a Jewish synagogue, and we're not told what kind of a building that was. But then he took a number of disciples with him and began meeting in a lecture hall where he preached daily for 2 years. Some kind of a lecture hall. We don't know a lot about it either. It's different speculation about what kind of a hall it was. And you know, they give the hours that they met there, and it almost seems like they were meeting there at an off time from a regular thing that happened at the hall. I don't know. We're just told that in Acts chapter 19, Paul withdrew from the synagogue, took the disciples with him, reasoning daily in the hall of Tyrannus, continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. So much of the gospel swept through Asia while Paul was lecturing in this particular format. Several of Paul's New Testament letters refer in passing to what are more than likely examples of churches that met in homes. Now, I've been taught at various times that, you know, that all the New Testament Christians, they always met in homes. You know, it wasn't until like the second or third century where they started meeting in buildings. And some level of truth to that, I think, but I, in preparation for this course, I was just doing some research and I came across a book. I don't remember the title, but I can give it to you if you're really interested, but I read through it rather quickly, where a guy makes a really good scholarly case for the fact that, yes, early Christians met in homes at times and frequently, but they met in a lot of different venues. It wasn't necessarily always in a home. He seemed to make a pretty good case. I didn't dig into it deep enough to stand behind what he's saying, but it did give me some pause for thought. But we do see examples in the New Testament where Paul seems to make statements that would reference church meetings in the home. Like you got the statement in the Roman letter, of course he's writing this from Corinth, and he's saying, Gaius, who is host to me, so apparently Paul, while he was staying in Corinth, was staying with Gaius, and to the whole church. The assumption there is that he hosts the church in its regular meetings. Doesn't say that, but not an unreasonable inference. Well, you have statements like in 1 Corinthians 16, Aquila and Priscilla, together with the church in their house, send you hearty greetings. Most of these comments Paul makes are sort of in passing in the greeting sections of his letters. Or Colossians. Give my greetings to the brothers at Laodicea and Nympha and the church in her house. So here seems to be a church that meets in the house. You could take the phrase church in your house as a reference to your family all being believers and the church of your... But more than likely, that's not the case with these. Philemon, maybe you could make that case, but again, not necessarily. To Philemon, our beloved fellow worker, and Apphia, our sister, and Archippus, our fellow soldier, and the church in your house. So just some phrases there that indicate that certainly meeting in the home was something that probably happened quite often in the early church. So what do we conclude from this? Well, here's my thought. With the variety of examples of church meeting places given in the New Testament, and here's the key, the absence of any command as to where a church ought to meet. You can remember we talked about descriptive versus prescriptive. You have to be very careful. Well, they all met in homes. We got to meet in homes. No. If they even all did meet in homes. Which they didn't. So with the absence of any command where a church ought to meet, it seems clear to me that New Testament churches have the liberty to meet wherever they see fit. Whatever works. Whatever is fitting. Whatever makes sense. Whatever is wise. There's nothing commanded. If a church chooses to meet indoors, which most do for obvious reasons, I mean, can you imagine meeting outside today? For example, there are going to be costs associated with the meeting place. Duh, right? And I'm being generic here. I'm going to zero in on a specific situation in just a moment, but many times there's a purchase price involved in a church building. I've been in many churches where they, you know, we're gonna get a new church building, and they're taking up a big collection and, you know, revving up support for the thing, you know. Cost money. Or I've been in churches and been exposed to churches where they don't even try to purchase a building. They just rent some space. Maybe they, I know Fellowship Bible Church for a long time met in a movie theater. During the off time, or they'll meet in some place that's not being occupied or used on Sunday morning, so it makes sense to rent it. I know Redeemer met in I think a Lutheran school or something when they first met on Saturdays. Anyhow, there's all different options there in terms of rental. You can do that, but particularly if you buy the place, you're going to also have other costs: maintenance, upkeep, utilities, insurance. If you want to talk to Jonathan Michon, I'm sure he can give you a more detailed list of those kinds of costs. And they're just, it's a part of being in a building, whatever building you're in. Now, we do get to our case. In the case of our church, we own the building and grounds, which is not always the case with churches, so that's a fortunate thing for us. But it currently requires about 50%, actually a little more than 50%, of our annual budget to cover the cost of maintenance, upkeep, utilities, insurance, etc., etc. That's a pretty substantial amount of money that we give to the church that's going to this. But my thought is the responsibility to cover these costs falls to us as members and thus becomes a part of our New Testament giving. You know, you could say, well, the Bible doesn't say we have to do that. It doesn't. But what do you want? You want to meet outside? You know? And if we're going to meet inside, who will pay for it? Now, I guess even if you look at a house church, somebody was paying for the house. The lecture hall at Tyrannus, I don't know what the financial arrangements were there. I have no idea. We're not told. But there probably were some. The temple obviously required maintenance and upkeep. I mean, it was an ongoing thing. It had been happening for years. But, you know, any place that you're going to have, it's going to require that. If you accept the fact you're going to meet indoors and accept that you're going to be part of the organization, it makes sense. Generally speaking, you bear responsibility as a member to pay that. I know I'm not giving you rocket science here, but I'm just trying to go back and rethink some of these things to work our way through and think clearly about something that maybe we just haven't thought about before. So that's as much, I think, as I want to say about the building. And here's the guy that knows all about it, and he's just walking in. Morning, Michon. So, glad we didn't lock the doors this morning. You'd be in trouble, wouldn't you? All right. Anybody want to say anything about that before we? Again, this is hodgepodge section, so we're just going to be dealing with this and that, and you know, thoughts or yeah.
Yeah, I have a coworker that this is a big passion of his that. He thinks that all churches should really be meeting at homes.
Uh-huh.
Just because of the whole budget issue that, you know, the building absorbs, like you pointed out, you know, a high percentage of it. So that really eliminates your tithing going outward.
Yeah.
It really is just staying in the building.
I mean, you could think about that. Of course, there's considerations to all that. I mean, First of all, I mean, I'm someone who, we actually tried to start a church in our home one time, you know. So somebody paid for that home, first of all, you have to remember. And maybe then all the burden falls to the homeowner unless people decide to help out. And maybe people don't even think to help out. Oh, it's their home. They take care of it anyways, you know. But it was a lot of work keeping up the home, and it was extra wear and tear. But here's another thing. How big can a church get when it's meeting in a home? Well, it depends on the home, I guess. And I suppose if you have an outbuilding like Martin has, I suppose a pretty good-sized church could meet. Martin wanted to have a church at his house, for example. He got an airplane hangar. So, you know, move the lawnmowers and put some pews in, we'd be good to go, right? I mean, yeah.
Well, I appreciate the discussion here.
Yeah.
So, one observation in the New Testament is obviously the difference in approaches to, say, the Jewish believers and also the Gentile believers. Acts chapter 2, I think, is predominantly Jewish believers who already have an associated connection with the temple. And it says that day after day, they went to the temple to worship, and they broke bread in the homes.
Yeah.
It's almost like, yeah, the fellowship is, the categorically worship is all alive.
Right.
Living sacrifices we're supposed to be. But also the corporate worship aspect, it's as if they were associating the private teaching and fellowship was in the home, and then the Jews were going to the temple for more of a ceremonial, should we say, more of a corporate style worship. And certainly the accommodations of the temple, like where the synagogues were larger, could fit more people. And the Jerusalem church at one point, you know, grew in a pretty large number where they would not have been able to meet as a single body in a church. So
yeah.
Even that whole concept of the discussion of multiple campuses and, you know, what constitutes an entire church are all relevant. Is a church what can fit between four walls?
Yeah.
You mentioned the open spaces, certainly. Lydia, so in order to constitute a synagogue, even you had to have so many people in the Jewish tradition. Lydia was meeting at the river because they didn't have, it's assumed, they didn't have the numbers to constitute a meeting. So whatever places are associated or you want to associate with a corporate gathering, that could be a building, could be a river, could be a schoolhouse, movie theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The options are wide open, and there's pros and cons to all of them. I mean, even like we own the building and grounds, and I've heard, you know, people think about, well, yeah, we do, but this is an old building and it's cost us a lot of money to keep it up. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it and a lot of pros and cons at any place you stay or go or meet. The thing is, we have liberty and we can always throw the question open.
I do think that it should be a manner or a matter of practicality and not of, you know, all these building projects. So we get a lot of junk mail at the church.
Yeah.
I have a magazine called Worship Facilities, and it is all about the elaborate decorations of a sanctuary and the millions of dollars that can go into having a state-of-the-art meeting space.
Yeah.
And I understand those churches that have larger means and larger congregants will need. Or it's so there's liberty perhaps in some of
there is,
but in so often even the building of St. Peter's Basilica, the vanity behind the worship building is a danger to be considered.
Yeah, it should be. It's hard to, you know, like my son, as you know, works with the audio and video. He goes to Fellowship Bible Church. We went there for years. And you go out there now, those of you who have been there, it's like a big mall, people have said. You know, they got a place you can stop and have coffee, and they've got several different large rooms they call venues, and they even have the luxury of having, you know, one service that meets with traditional hymns, one that meets with, you know, a rock band. And then they all share the same sermon by means of a video screen. And, you know, it's a very elaborate setup. Then there's places, in fact, they do some of this, where they pipe out the sermons to other campuses. And, you know, there's all kind of things you can get into, and there's a lot of questions that can be raised about how big should a church get before it becomes, like, crazy. And
lots of issues. And there are some who would say upon visiting our building that we are vain in having more than we need as well.
Sure.
It's a great conversation.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, the thing we just have to kind of come back to is it is an area of liberty, and there's no hard and fast rules. It just becomes a matter of practicality and wisdom, and it becomes a part of the church's personality, if you will, and what the elders think. And it's just something that has to be worked out individually. And it's not ever locked in stone either. I mean, you could get to a point where a church has been always meeting this way and decides it makes sense to meet that way, or however they want to do it. The question can be asked, can be open, because there's not any set rule about how you do it. So, kind of a fascinating thing to think about. I was especially interested in that book I read that they didn't meet in, necessarily always meet in house churches. I hadn't encountered that thought before, but it was a very carefully done study, and a lot of what he had to say made sense. All worth entertaining. Giving to God-honoring organizations. So there, as you know, are a number of God-honoring organizations today who depend on financial contributions in order to help the poor or serve the cause of the gospel in some way. I'm being very generic here. I mean, it's untold numbers of organizations who do untold numbers of things. The New Testament does not mention such organizations, and so giving to them is not required. But to the extent that these organizations help the poor or serve the cause of the gospel, our support for them could be viewed as part of our giving to the poor or support for ministers of the gospel, which the New Testament does talk about. So you could extend it that way. You remember last week when I played for you some conversation from Jason, and he talked about having a portfolio of things that he gives to, and he looks to a number of organizations for an outlet to give to the poor, and he doesn't give all of his money to the poor in that way. He does give some to individuals, but he does rely on organizations because he feels like, I don't remember if I played this part of his conversation or not, but he's told me that in many cases he feels like these organizations just do far better than he could do individually. They have resources, they put thought into it, they've got experience, they've got, you know, the organization that backs them up in what they're doing. And he just couldn't begin to reproduce that and the effectiveness. Oh, like we talked about, Martin and the Union Rescue Mission, there's a whole organization there that's doing things that, you know, we know the frustration of dealing with the homeless guy on the street corner. They do that all the time, and they're equipped to do that, and they do it in a way that's I think is productive and helpful without being harmful to those guys, and doesn't enable them, gives them an out if they want it. That's something that's hard for us to do because we're on our way to work. We're busy. We don't have time for that sometimes, oftentimes. So organizations can serve a valuable function. It can be a part of the way that we do the giving that we've talked about doing. And I almost didn't give this, but I just wanted to kind of give some specific, because the danger of what I'm about to do is I'm picking like a half dozen organizations, and there are just thousands, if not millions of them out there, and I feel like I'm being unfair in exposing you to the ones that most of these I've given to. But I just want to give you some ideas, kind of things that, you know, I think about giving to. Alpha and Omega Ministry, some of you know about James White. He goes around, he's a pastor in a church, but he has a ministry where he goes around the world and has formal debates with various cults and false religions and an attempt to get the gospel in front of people through that format. It's an encouragement to Christians. It's an outreach to unbelievers. Answers in Genesis is one I like. You guys know I have a passion for, you know, creation and young earth and things like that. And Answers in Genesis is all about shoring up, coming alongside and shoring up local churches in this area, an area that's kind of hard to do research in. It's kind of hard to have a lot of broad knowledge without having a team of scientists who, you know, do this kind of research. And Answers in Genesis does. They provide a museum, and they got a model of the ark now and all this kind of crazy stuff. And I just like them, and they're an organization we've supported for many, many years. Campus Crusade for Christ. They now call themselves CRU. They decided that using the word crusade when you're trying to reach out to Muslims might not be a good idea. My son's particularly aware of that over in the Middle East. As you know, my son's a part of this. I had a lot of misgivings about him getting involved in this organization because I always felt like Campus Crusade was a little bit competitive with the local church on campuses. And I didn't like that. I still don't like that. Because I know a lot of times Jason felt like even himself. Now, he always committed to me that he would go to a local church, and he always has. I will grant him his faithfulness in that. He's very good about that. So this is not a knock against Jason, but I expressed concern to him about the role that they play with the Bible studies and all that they do on campus. They're not really pushing people into local churches particularly. They don't discourage you. They say, yeah, you should join a local church, but they don't point you anywhere. They don't push that. And functionally, it becomes like a church for the kids on campus. And some people might say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, it's not the way the Bible structures. You know, it's not. You can't have elders and deacons and old people. And it's not a church. It's good stuff. It's like a Bible study. So, and they carry the gospel around the world. They're very organized. And you know, I just have mixed feelings about them. I'm just throwing them out there as an organization that in some ways is worthy of support. We support them for obvious reasons, because we have people who are in it. Little Door International. Our church has recently taken on Little Door International. They're doing the work that they do over in Burma. There's a spread of the gospel involved in that. There's a helping of poor, but helping the poor in a way where they help themselves. Curtis Thomas and the others who have built that ministry have done a very, very good job of structuring things. We're not just giving handouts all the time. They do give money, but it's given in a way that encourages development and work on the part of the recipients. Something not a lot of organizations do. So I was real happy that our church chose this organization. I've been given to them for quite some time. Not a lot, but just they're on my list. I like them. Jason mentioned Voice of the Martyrs. This is an organization that reaches out and tries to help Christians in places in the world that are persecuted. So you talk about helping poor Christians. This is a place you can do that. Lottie Moon, you know, I thought I'd mention that. Every year we give a plug for Lottie Moon here. It's part of the Southern Baptist. And all these organizations, there's pros and there's cons and there's ups and there's downs. And, you know, you can argue endlessly about them. I'm just saying there's options there to think about. And I suppose probably everybody in this room, to some degree or another, supports some kind of organization like this. Just wanted to mention it as an area. All right, I want to deal with one last question before we wrap up here. I just got a message, by the way, just for FYI, that I love this. My hearing aid batteries go out at some random time every time during the week. And this happened one other time in class, so I may turn you all loose for a little bit in a bit here. When they come up and say, battery. That means you got about 20 minutes, bud, and then your batteries are gone. You're not going to hear nothing. So when I start pulling my hearing aids out, you know what that's all about. Okay. One of the realities of life, of all the times, you know, right? But it's got to happen sometime. Giving corporately and individually. The last question I would like to look at concerning giving, especially giving to the poor, what are the advantages to giving individually versus corporately? I don't know if you've really even thought about this, but it's something I think is worthy of a little thought. I would say, obviously, there's a place for both. So I'm not trying to make an either-or out of this deal. But I thought it would be helpful to look at the differences between the idea of giving corporately versus the idea of giving individually. And we have some scriptural passages we can look at to start with. I always like to start with scripture when I can. There are a number of New Testament passages that show giving taking place at a corporate level. I was surprised at how often I saw that. A passage like Acts chapter 4, where it talks about those who believe were one heart and soul and so forth. And at the end there it says they took money, they sold their own land. So they individually owned property. They would sell the property that they owned for the purpose of helping the local body, members of a local body. But rather than selling the land and walking up and handing it to a fellow believer and say, here you go. They took the money from the sale and laid it at the apostles' feet, with the elders in their setting there. Gave it to the elders of their church, if you will, put it in a modern context. And the apostles distributed to each as had need. So the money was funneled through a central, I would consider this corporate giving situation. In Acts 6, the widows were cared for by what we presume, I would have to say that because the word is not actually used, our deacons chosen at a corporate level, so it was a corporate arrangement within the church to take care of widows. If you think about the biggest giving that's talked about throughout the New Testament, and what almost every study on giving is going to reference passages having to do with this collection, Paul organized the collection for the poor saints at Jerusalem in such a way that the money was given not by individuals, not even by individual congregations. Instead, Paul solicited and gathered money from a number of local Gentile churches and presented it as one offering to the church at Jerusalem. Him being there, and there were a number of delegates present with him from various of the churches that had contributed. Paul had his reasons for doing what he did with that collection. I'm not trying to make too much of it. But it clearly was an example of taking money, funneling it through one. I mean, all the Gentile churches could have made little trips to Jerusalem and each presented their own thing, you know, or I suppose they could have sent money even on an individual basis. They didn't do it that way. Paul wanted to have it come through him corporately from the Gentile churches as a group. Again, he had his reasons, but apparently that can play out and be a reason. Paul seems to have in mind the corporate funding of widows in 1 Timothy 5. He gives instructions to the church about who are widows indeed and who are not, and it's just a whole discussion there about that. We've quoted some passages out of that section. So there's plenty of examples. I could have, I think, given others. I started to give others. I thought, well, that's enough, of corporate giving in the New Testament. But I'm not trying to say it's all that way. There are obviously many instances that involve individual giving. I mean, obviously the Good Samaritan was an individual, right? We saw that example. Jesus' instructions about inviting the poor to a feast. He said, don't just invite people that are rich who can pay you back. Invite people who are poor, who are needy, and help them. Well, whoever's sending out the invitations, more than likely, is not a corporation. This is probably an individual having a party or a feast at their house. Zacchaeus was an individual, and he gave, upon coming to Christ, gave half of his money to the poor. Cornelius was giving to the poor when he was an unbeliever and was commended for it by God. He was an individual who was giving to the poor. Jesus' admonition to the sheep and the goats were addressed to individuals on the day of judgment. He's not corporately addressing some large group. I mean, there's a large group maybe present, but individually they are held accountable for their individual giving or lack thereof. And same with the admonitions to help poor fellow believers that we looked at in James chapter 2. Help your fellow brother. Or 1 John 3, how can you look at your fellow brother? I mean, you could maybe view that sort of corporately, but really that comes down to the individual making that assessment about their brother or sister. So plenty of examples of corporate and individual giving. And this is actually our closing question. If we get done early today, fine, but I could envision this being an interesting discussion. So what would you see as the advantages and disadvantages of corporate giving as compared to individual giving? I would contend there are advantages and disadvantages, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. And again, this is all we have to discuss, so don't feel like you got to end discussion. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like you can have a bigger impact with individual giving, at least with that one person. That your money goes a lot further for that one person doing it individually.
If you do it individually? Yeah. Well, certainly as an individual, it's more personal. It's not just coming from some nameless, faceless whatever. It's coming from me, you know, to you. And that feels personal, right? So yeah, that's certainly the obvious advantage of individual giving. And plus, maybe this is implicit in what you're stating too, but let me read too much into it, but you definitely know if you give it, you can see what's going on. You have more of a sense that you know what you're giving to, although you can be fooled. We can all be fooled. but you tend to have more of a feeling of confidence that, you know, I gave, I saw the situation, I know what I gave to, I saw the reaction. I can feel good about where my money went. It's not like I gave it to some organization and I think they're doing good things. Their website looks great. But, you know, who knows, right? So that's an advantage of individual giving, definitely. Anybody have other advantages or want to talk about advantages to corporate giving? Lindabeth.
I like both. I mean, corporate, you're going to have have waste in a sense. We were just talking about the church building is like half is sort of wasted on the building. So it's there could be waste either way. They waste where an individual is not really being responsible with the money or help that you gave them, or you know, organization has to pay their workers or you know, whatever. But I actually really enjoy individually, but hardly ever do because of the reasons we've stated in the past couple of weeks.
You take my battery. Keep talking. Go ahead. I'm listening. I got one ear that still works.
Okay. But yeah, so recently I was checking out, and I'm normally pretty chatty with the cashier, and this little black lady was saying how like, she's fixing to go to another job, and she was talking about her different jobs, and she was not complaining. She was just saying all these different jobs she has. She has children, and here she is at, you know, 9:30 at night checking me out, and I have a sweet husband at home. You know, and anyway, all that to say, she had just said, oh, I'm getting my paycheck. And she said, actually, my paycheck is what the same thing as what you're spending right now.
Oh, wow.
And you can take that either way. My thought was that wasn't very much money. but then I just realized how blessed I was.
Yeah.
That, and she said, dang, you must have a husband. And anyway, I at the end of it felt like I really wanted to bless her, so I gave her some money, not very much, but some money just to say, can you go enjoy yourself, use something versus
yeah.
Maybe save you. Anyway, that's probably not really a poor person. I commend her for having three jobs. That's instead of
working
off the government. But I found that so neat. Her reaction was just. It was just really sweet. It was just no entitlement.
Yeah.
It was just a joy. And so it was, for me, it was good to see that personal reaction versus giving to a ministry. I don't always get to see the blessing. So, but it's hard because I don't like giving to individuals, as we've stated before. So
that comes back to, again, what we kind of talked about with Aaron, you know, the sense of personal involvement. You get to see it. You get to feel the response, you know, and all that. Now, I would want to suggest a little bit of a reframing. You talk about this waste when you have a corporation, and there can be, but I would frame it, there may be waste or there may not be waste, but there is overhead. I would call it overhead, which is not necessarily waste. You understand what I'm saying? So, but is there an advantage to giving corporately? You said you like giving corporately. Yeah.
I think one advantage to giving corporately is that, you know, if I'm contributing personally to like maybe 5 or 10 different things, which means I'm giving less to each of those individually. Granted, we already said that people could individually give to these certain areas that the corporate mentality would be giving to, but they're pooling and funneling of that. They're taking my little bit that I'm giving to them. They're taking everybody else's little bit. They're bringing it all together, and they're giving huge chunks, more than just me giving $5. They're giving everybody's $5 to specific things. So depending on the need at any given time, there's almost a deeper impact on one individual area that the need is being applied to.
Right. So. Yeah, and I think, and this may be kind of behind what you're seeing too, in business there's this thing called the economy of scale. Have you heard that term before? It has to do with the fact that when you spend larger sums of money, you can do things in a bigger way, and there's a certain economy to that, that if you try to do it on an individual basis, you just can't get that kind of, you know, it's like buying quantity discounts. It's an example of economy of scale. If you go to a business, most businesses will sell you something at a much lower price per item if you buy a large quantity. Why is that? Well, because you're doing big business, so you can get a better break. And corporations pooling a lot of resources can get breaks in the way that they do things, economy of scale. So that's an advantage too. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that's I think part of what you see when you see the corporate ability to take all this. I just think about the difference between, like, I've been a member of all different sized churches. You know, our church is fairly small. I've been in smaller. I've been in bigger. You know, I've been in Fellowship Bible Church. You know, it's been huge for a long, long time. When they do things at Fellowship Bible Church, they do it in a big way, in a way we could never think about doing here, right? And even as it filters down to the individual experience, whatever that experience is, whether it's a big event or a concert or a get together or whatever it was they're putting on, a conference. They can just do so much more because they're pulling all this money together and economy of scale. Another thing too is just the ability to pull together expertise. Just statistically, I mean, we have some smart people in our church, but statistically, when you have a massive organization, you're drawing from all kinds of resources mentally in terms of ability to plan. Even if those people aren't on the staff or on the committee, they're in the organization, they have an interest in what's going on. They might come to the people who are making the plan and say, hey, I know about this particular thing, and I can help you here, or I can give you some really good advice. And, you know, we may not have that ability here. If we happen to hit the person who has that talent or ability or insight, great. But statistically, they're going to do a lot better at that. And just even the ability to put things in place, rules and practices and facilities, you know, like the Union Rescue Mission. How can we reproduce that individually? We can't. It's not a big deal, but they just have a place where they put people up. They've got policies in place. They've got experience behind them saying, yep, we've dealt with these kind of people before. We know what they're like. We know what you have to do and what you don't do. Right? Yeah.
I was going to say, bouncing off of that, that is, I think, a very good example of where corporate is absolutely better than individual, because I could easily give $5 to the person on the street that's walking by, but if I were to instead give to that ministry that you're talking about,
yeah,
and instead encourage that person to go there, if they're willing to do so and they go there, they're not only going to get shelter over their head, they're not only going to get fed, they're also going to, you know, this corporate, the resources that they have are going to try and get them a stable job, get them on their feet, all of these things, where that's going to stretch a lot more than any monetary amount of money that I personally give to them.
Yeah. I mean, you can't do that. Or if you did, you could do it to one or two people. You couldn't do it institutionally to a citywide. Yeah.
Pros and cons, advantages and disadvantages, case by case.
Yeah.
Perhaps. One of the organizations I like is Heifer International.
Okay.
The infrastructure of a lot of these organizations can allow your $1 to stretch tremendously far.
Yeah.
A lot of overhead, sure, but even with the overhead, it's still possible with the remaining percentage, it's still doing more than you would be able to do individually. The advantage to individual is the potential of relationships there.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the number of times I've sat down with someone who was trying to get my partnership for a ministry that they're entering into, and I asked them questions about their connection to a local church, and in many cases, they're self-commissioning themselves. They've really not even ever talked to their pastor about what they're setting out to do. And I see a lot of danger in that as well. When I give individually, what I hope to see is that money is going to be stewarded for the purpose in which I'm intending it to be used for. And in a lot of cases, if you can have that relationship, I mean, that's great. Corporately, you're also trusting that the boards that are overseeing those organizations are maintaining the right ethics regarding the finances. And you're taking risk either way, whether you are trusting that individual to do it or you're trusting that corporation. But case by case, perhaps not all organizations are created equal.
That's true, and it behooves us to investigate who we're giving to. And that's where the accountability comes back to the individual, is if you're going to give to a large organization, and there's no perfect organization, but there are some that do have a lot of waste, and there's some that have very little. There's some that are very wise in how they approach things. They take an approach that really helps the people they're helping, and there's others that just throw money at things and actually end up hurting people.
I do like in the story of the Good Samaritan how we see both in a way, in that at the beginning, he strives to take care of this guy himself. And when he gets to the point where he knows that he needs to hand this responsibility off to someone else, he goes to that innkeeper and says, hey, I'm moving on in my travels.
Yeah.
You take it from here.
Right.
And if there's anything, any more medical costs or lodging costs, then, you know, I'll help take care of that. But he did what he could himself. Mm-hmm. And then he handed it off to somebody.
Other thoughts?
One of the things that I've seen in terms of missions is like the different strategies, like Southern Baptist, we tend to give to, you mentioned Lottie Moon,
yeah,
International Mission Board. And I've, having grown up in the Southern Baptist or in Southern Baptist churches, you know, what I've heard is usually the criticism of, well, it's kind of faceless. You know, you're giving to an organization that's giving to these missionaries. And so it always seemed a little bit unbiblical because, you know, unless you were really intentional about it, and some churches are, you don't really establish that connection with the missionaries. And I have a really good friend who went from a Southern Baptist church to an independent Baptist church that was basically, that was the only difference between them theologically. And he hates the way that they do missions because they do have a lot of missionaries who come through and that they give to, but he said the problem is you can see it whenever somebody comes. The really good speakers and the ones who are really good at presentations are the ones who end up, you know, getting a lot of support from people.
Yeah.
And then the ones who aren't as good at that, but they may be very faithful and good missionaries, aren't getting as much, or they have to be able to actually come to us in order to get that support. You know?
Interesting.
And
yeah,
he said, I just so much prefer the International Mission Board and being able to know that, you know, that they're taking care of all of these missionaries and that they're accountable to them, and I can just work on my accountability with that organization versus the individual. And I think that that can apply, you know, giving to the poor. You know, I've got to make this judgment,
yeah,
real quick, whereas if I give to Union Rescue Mission or something like that, I'm trusting that they're able to make that judgment and to help them even more.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what you hope for in terms of corporate giving, is you hope for some level of wisdom in the organization. Yeah. And even think about giving to the apostle or giving to our local church. I mean, we could technically, you say, you know, share all good things with those who teach you. I suppose we could do, and we do to some degree do, help our pastors individually, right? I've done that before. Because he's my pastor, I just give him something extra. Just I think about him being my pastor. But I also give to the church. You know, so it's, you know, you can do both, again. But why would you funnel money through the church? Well, it gives the pastor some kind of a stable base to draw from. It. They can't, individual donations, you know, right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. I know it's a principle of giving for the individual, but but it doesn't help much if you're depending on the church for support. You know, one day 50 people may decide you think you're a great guy, and they're all gonna, you know, come up and give you, and then for the next 3 months nobody says anything, you know, and it doesn't work too good. So when we pool the funds together, there's a knowledge base, there's a wisdom there, and I even think about, like I told you, the Bible Church, we went there for a while. They had a policy dealing with people who were poor. And I felt like, in a way, giving money to the Bible Church was not just supporting the pastors in the building, but it was helping the poor. And they did a very good job of helping the poor. I mean, I don't know if they were as good as Union Rescue Mission, but they had policies in place. They didn't just, somebody came knock on the door, they didn't just go, oh, here's a few bucks and send them on the way, which is the easy thing most people try to do, just to, you know, get it to move on. They didn't do that. They would sit them down and they would make them go through a process and make them commit to a process before they would continue to help them. And I thought that was good too. Wisdom, bringing the elders into it, bringing the church into it. There's reasons for all that kind of stuff. And again, not to take away from individual, I think both have their place. That's why we're having this discussion. I want to get people to think that
one
way.
One of the thoughts, yeah, that I had is the passage about them giving to the apostles' feet and almost handing off to a group of people who theoretically are aware of more of the landscape happening and can discern how to use that. Maybe the individual knows a piece of the puzzle, but isn't aware of some other things that are more confidential going on, which would better inform them. And so by delegating it out, you're giving it, you're deferring to the wisdom of some others.
Yeah, could smoke out the Ananias and Sapphira that the individual might not have.
Okay, when we're doing an individual too, I can relate with the feeling of being overwhelmed by so many options out there.
Yeah.
I feel burdened. I just read an article that Answers in Genesis is losing lots of money.
Really?
At that museum. Whether it's because of some tax free support that they were anticipating the state giving them that didn't come through, or whatever it is, I just saw that that they're losing some money on that project, and I felt burdened about that. But that's an overwhelming thing. What's $1 or?
Yeah.
What one person can give compared to the massive needs there. So easy to get overwhelmed, and so discernment is needed.
It's true. I think you had a question a while ago, Aaron. I'm sorry, I forgot to come back to you. Cause
I think it's something with giving corporately is you may not always agree with their tactics.
That's true.
Like, you might have a church that wants a big event and bouncy houses and all that. And
yeah. What's wrong with bouncy? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, that you do get into that. You end up, okay, it's good because the economy of scale and wisdom and all the things we talk about, but it's the downside is that I like 75% of what they do, or 85 or 96% of what they do, but there's this little piece that really bothers me.
Yeah.
And that's life, you know. I mean, you make those choices in life all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a trade-off, and you got to decide individually whether the trade-off's worth it to do the corporate thing or not, you know. So, but that's a good point, though. That is a good point. All right. Man, see, that discussion did take the rest of our time. I figured it would. It's just one of those things that it's... But I hope it's been helpful. I hope we're done with this now. We're going to move back to New Covenant theology, and our study really is going to be on New Covenant theology again next week. So we'll be moving ahead with that. I just... the elders had kind of suggested I do this, and I'm glad I did. I hope it's been helpful to you. I hope it was a useful diversion, if you or not a diversion, but a useful segue, if you will, off into a different area. Father, thank you for this time to consider giving, a very important part of our Christian life. It's probably the true measure of who we are in many ways. Help us to take these things seriously, to give careful reflection individually. Perhaps in some cases we would look at what we do and say, yeah, I still affirm what I do. Or in some cases we might look at what we do and say, some things need to change. Help each of us to reflect appropriately and in a way that honors you. We ask in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.